This is Inside the Revival, a production of Silencia, streaming on demand on Healthcare Now Radio. Inside the Revival explores the human side of the psychedelic renaissance, where ancient wisdom meets modern science and consciousness meets clinical care. I'm Greg Masters, co-creator and executive producer with my partner co-creator and healthcare technology advocate, storyteller, and explorer of the frontiers of where mind, medicine, and meaning intersect, Jim Tate. Together, we bring you deep dialogue with pioneers in psychedelic research, integrative healing, and mindful medicine. Together, we're peeling back the layers of the psychedelic revival from neuroscience to spirituality, policy to practice, asking one simple question: what does it mean to heal in the age of awakening? Stay tuned. Inside the Revival begins now.
I want to welcome Ben Malcolm to this episode. Ben, better known as the Spirit Pharmacist, brings comprehensive education in psychedelic pharmacology and consulting that increases safety and optimizes benefits of psychedelic use. Ben, thanks for joining me today.
It's a real pleasure to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
You're in Costa Rica. I'm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I wish I was with you. Maybe before too long, I'll come down and see you in the flesh.
That would be wonderful. And, you know, I've been working on establishing myself down here. Right now I have my online psychopharmacology consulting and psychedelic education related business, Spirit Pharmacist, but I've been really trying to get a physical counterpart down here going that I'm calling Casa de Espiritu.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm really, I think probably a year or few away from getting that to the real place that I envision overall, but I do have a casita or guest house that's ready now. Right. And so anytime that you want to come down, I would be happy to host you, Jim. It would be a real pleasure.
I appreciate that. I took a look at that. That's a nice casita you have set up there.
It is very nice.
Yeah,
right? It's
exactly. Yeah. Okay. You know, you are a traditional academic psychiatric pharmacist. What caused you to transition over to the Spirit Pharmacist?
Well, probably a few things. You know, like I became intellectually fascinated with, I think, just psychoactives really around the age of even 14 or 15. And through reading about psychoactives or essentially drugs that had addictive sorts of, I don't know, tendencies to them, I discovered psychedelics at a really early age, even from an intellectual related perspective. And through reading about different drugs that were less regulated as illicit compounds, I became aware that it was just something different about the effects of psychedelics compared to, I think, what we think of as, you know, highly addictive types of substances. And so that intellectual curiosity really led to an experiential curiosity. And I tried things like MDMA and psilocybin mushrooms during my undergraduate years. And really had absolutely fabulous times and experiences, you know, camping with friends and things like that. And then I graduated undergraduate, and the trail was kind of like cold in some ways. I studied pharmacology in undergrad because it was just a natural extension of what I was intellectually interested in at that time. And it seemed like there was, you know, some sort of career path forward with that type of knowledge. And I decided to go to pharmacy school mostly as an extension of, yeah, I'm interested in that. This seems like the kind of curriculum that would kind of develop that, I don't know, intellectual passion further. But I didn't go to pharmacy school because I had some vision of becoming a retail pharmacist. And in fact, I'd been working in retail pharmacy as a pharmacy technician for a couple of years before that, a couple of gap years after undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And I'd already kind of decided, like, I really don't think that's for me overall. So I really went into pharmacy school with this kind of like open mind that I'm here to gain all of the information that is offering and take as many of the opportunities that it can, really open as many doors as possible, was really sort of how I was approaching going into pharmacy school. I got into a first year residency program afterwards. I was working at a hospital, so just acute care, just a general hospital pharmacy residency. And although I really appreciated some of the complexity of the drug regimens and aspects of hospital pharmacy, it also really just didn't feel like it was for me. And even in that year, I was starting to get burnt out. And somebody just kind of handed me a flyer at some point for a second year residency in psychiatric pharmacy. And this is like 2013, 2014 now, and something just clicked. It was kind of, you're going to do the second year residency in psychiatric pharmacy. That's going to qualify you for an entry level position in academia. In academia, you're going to have protected time to research the questions that you want to research and give continuing education and talks about the subjects you want to talk about. And, you know, this is again like 2013, 2014, 2015 at this point. And the scene around psychedelic research had changed. The medical sort of renaissance was in full swing at that time. You know, Spravato or esketamine was FDA approved. MDMA-assisted therapy had been granted a breakthrough designation for treatment refractory PTSD. There were several pilot studies with psilocybin that had, you know, positive data coming out of it. And there was even other types of observational research with things like ayahuasca demonstrating different types of health benefits. And all of a sudden it was like, well, for an information dealer, there's really something to stand upon here, right? It's not this kind of, oh, there's no research, and so we don't know about that, and it's regulated as an illicit substance, and so we're just going to assume that it fits the definition of that category of regulation, right? And so all of a sudden, it was apparent to me that there's an opportunity for somebody to deal a much more objective level of information about these types of things. And in academia, I had been publishing articles to that effect within medical journals or within the ivory tower. But a lot of that's behind paywall, or even if it's not behind paywall, the technicality of how those things are written is just not very accessible to the person that actually wants and needs the information to make empowered healthcare decisions, maybe empowered psycho-spiritual sorts of decisions. And so it was like, I need to create a public facing website that at least focuses on education. And I had a couple other friends that were doing work with psychedelics that started asking me questions about drug regimens and screening, which made it apparent that, you know, a consulting counterpart was really something that was organically in demand.
Absolutely.
Would help a person set and setting, increase the safety and optimize the benefits. And that's exactly what the heart of pharmacy is about, right? And so I decided to run with it and created the website Spirit Pharmacist. And I don't know, I could probably tell you more about the exact events. Or, you know, we were chatting for a few minutes beforehand about some of the, I don't know, even fortuitous events, right? Like I don't know, I hesitate to say that the pandemic was fortuitous. I think that for a lot of persons, it created a lot of hardship and there was a lot of loss and grief, right? But in some ways, it was also a great shakeup. I think that myself included and a lot of other persons, it was all of a sudden the regular duties and obligations of your life were not there anymore. Or they just weren't there anyway. And it was like, hey, if you're doing something that you don't like right now, this is almost a get out of it. Like all you just play it as an excuse card. And right. It was also an opportunity for persons to reorganize the priorities of their life, to really make the things that they care about at the top of the list and, you know, make things that really weren't serving them or didn't hold that much value as far as improving their life, or maybe they were burning them out or something like that. Like, I think a lot of persons all of a sudden was like, why am I making a 75-minute commute both directions when I can do this job at home? Have I been doing this? Right? And so there was a lot of synchronicity, fortuitous related things or silver linings in that period of time that opened my eyes to what the possibilities were. And I decided to go through the open door that was opened.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know your website, a lot of webinars there, a lot of education there. You supply, you know, first heard your name, Ben, from a number of retreat centers who said, oh, yeah. I said, you know, how do you come up with these protocols or best practices and, you know, around folks who are on SSRIs and want to come do psychedelics? And they say, well, we contacted Ben, the Spirit Pharmacist, and, you know, but you also have individuals who contact you. And so an individual contacts you, says, I've been on Lexapro for 15 years, I want to try and get off, how can I safely titrate down? What kind of advice do you give them? Like, what are best practices for longtime users of SSRIs if they want to try and get off? outside of the psychedelic realm?
Yeah, so I think in a nutshell, when I have a long-term user of an SSRI type of antidepressant, I'm kind of thinking that if they're going to taper and stop that medication, there's probably a few things that can kind of help them. One, I think, is slower step downs or smaller step downs than maybe some of what the guidelines recommend or what some of their, you know, current or former prescribers have recommended. There's a huge variability in sensitivity to antidepressant withdrawal or antidepressant discontinuation syndrome. So I think some of the guidelines might say you can go 25% every 4 to 7 days. For a person that's not on the lowest dose, that's been taking that for a number of years or even decades overall, that's usually an intolerable rate. Or if they can make it through the taper period, it becomes intolerable within the first few months after stopping. Mm. And so generally speaking, I'm kind of thinking 10 to 25% step downs every 2 to 4 weeks as tolerated. But there's also a number of websites out there that document, I would say, almost an extreme level of sensitivity. And for those persons, they need to go even slower, right? There's almost like a rule of thumb from some of those websites that if you make dose decreases of 10% or less, then it still doesn't guarantee that you're not going to go through something or feel discontinuation symptoms, but they're typically in the mild to moderate range rather than in the severe kind of range. But like you're saying, you know, when persons come to me and ask this question, how should I stop my antidepressant? There's an I for an individual in that. And so I can talk about these general sorts of taper rates. There's other methods. There's hyperbolic tapering, which tends to go faster in the top half of the range and then really go very, very slow and make a number of, frankly, tedious, but sometimes necessary, very small dose decreases towards the end of the taper period. But boy, I mean, SSRIs, what could that be used for? Depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, neuropathic pain, some other four-letter acronym in psychiatry that's come down the pike in the last 10 or 15 years, right? Some combination of those types of things. Okay, depression, what does that mean? Does that mean that there's a mild level of low mood and dissatisfaction with stuff and, you know, I find it hard to be motivated to go to the gym sometimes, right? Or does it mean I can't get out of bed? I'm thinking of harming myself and I've been to a psychiatric unit involuntarily a couple of times for suicidal ideation or suicidal attempts. And every single time I've tried to taper the medication, it's led to one of those crises events. I mean, like, and so there's an element in the consulting, right, where, yeah, again, like there's general rules of thumb around tapering that are generally going to be helpful for persons to understand and be aware of. But then when there's how should I taper my antidepressant, it's really all of those other factors that maybe even get us towards thinking, should I do that? Or maybe I should be aiming for a lower dose that retains some of the efficacy or benefits and lightens some of the side effect burden. That might actually be the outcome that the person is best suited by. But generally, I'm kind of thinking that right, there's these standard taper rates, which are a bit too aggressive and have really underplayed the risks of antidepressant discontinuation or the prevalence of it for a very long time. I'm really happy to see, I think, more psychiatric organizations and guidelines recognizing that for some persons, it can be very, very difficult to stop. And there's a greater awareness of that. But boy, I still get a lot of emails that's kind of like, you know, my psychiatrist recommended I take myself from 200 milligrams of sertraline or Zoloft, which is the FDA maximum approved dose for depression, to zero in 3 weeks. And that seems a bit fast for me. What do you think?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't necessarily want to shoot at the hip, but it does sound too fast. And let's meet and talk about all those other factors to see what you might want to try. And in a lot of ways, too, I think that, you know, persons want the results that they want as fast as possible. But it's a little tortoise in the hair, like Aesop's fable kind of race, I think, when you're thinking about stopping something that's been a part of your life and there's at least a physical, if not psychological, kind of dependence on at the same kind of time. And so, you know, there's probably many ways that persons can stop their antidepressants, But if the goal is to be off of it in a long-term sustainable way, then you probably want to go a little bit slower than maybe you even think you should. And sometimes, I'll phrase it in other ways for persons. It's like, hey, instead of, 40 milligrams of citalopram that you want to lose, imagine that I was a weight loss coach and your question was, how should I lose 40 pounds, right? Would the answer be starve yourself on a yo-yo diet and get it off in a month? Or would the answer be make small, sustainable lifestyle changes that allow you to take that 40 milligrams off over a period of 6 months, and you're not going to put yourself on a physiological yo-yo that might make you end up back on that medication or now on two medications because it was just so bad, right?
Yeah, we keep hearing the phrase, or I keep, serotonin syndrome. Folks on SSRIs involved with psychedelics and what is serotonin syndrome?
Serotonin syndrome is a form of poisoning, right? So it's a form of toxicity that's associated with, classically excessive levels of intrasynaptic serotonin, or the amount of serotonin that's located in the space between two neurons, right? That's the synapse or the space between the neurons. So intrasynaptic serotonin, right, is the amount that's there or the levels that's there. It's probably associated with postsynaptic receptor signaling too. You've got way too much serotonin in the synapse, which is causing just an excessive level of postsynaptic receptor signaling. But essentially, you have to have drugs that increase serotonin to get that type of toxicity. And the major classes that are capable of doing that are the SSRIs. They inhibit serotonin reuptake or trap serotonin in the synapse. There's monoamine oxidase inhibitors, which block the breakdown of serotonin. And then there's agents which actually cause excessive levels of release from the presynaptic neuron. And those are things like MDMA, right, is your classic serotonin releasing agent. So typically, just having one of those agents in of itself isn't quite enough to lead to this type of syndrome. And it really is a life-threatening type of toxicity. So I reserve the word serotonin syndrome for something that's characterized by myoclonic seizures, right? The myoclonic seizures, there's a lot of rigidity and high amplitude, contractions, particularly of extremities. That contraction leads to excessive levels of hyperthermia. So myoclonic seizures, excessive hyperthermia. We're talking like fevers of at least 102, if not like 104 plus Fahrenheit, right? Like at least 38, 38.5 centigrade, but probably more like more than 40 degree centigrade. So these are like brain damage levels of hyperthermia. And then altered mental status, which I think at the shallow end of the pool could be like extreme panic and agitation. But as it really gets extreme, something like comatose or obtunded, right? So I meet a lot of persons that, and there's different, like, okay, the Hunter criteria essentially defines serotonin syndrome the way that I just said with that classic triad of symptoms, or but there's other types of criteria out there that I think are a lot looser, that are pretty good as far as their sensitivity goes, but they really lack specificity, meaning that they will catch all the cases of serotonin syndrome out there, but they catch a lot of other things that really aren't a life-threatening toxicity. So it's sensitive, but not very specific for the diagnosis. And some of those criteria look at things like feeling hot, having some sweatiness, dilated pupils, upset stomach, panic or agitation, which starts to look like a person that's really having a challenging moment with a psychedelic trip, right? That really isn't in the realm of severe life-threatening pathophysiology, right? And so there's really a spectrum of excessive serotonin all the way from a little bit extra, where you're getting side effect profiles of things like, okay, you start an SSRI, anxiety, headache, upset stomach. These are just classic transient side effects a person can get in the first days to weeks after starting SSRIs. Okay, the clinical trials of things like psilocybin or MDMA, transient anxiety, physical discomfort, nausea, upset stomach, dilated pupils, right? Okay, these are just side effects associated with psychedelic serotonergics, right? As far as the drug ingestions go, but they're not in the realm of that moderate to severe life-threatening type of toxicity where, okay, yeah, you're having the seizures, you know, you're getting this brain damage level of hyperthermia, that muscles are so contracted that they start breaking down, clogging up the kidneys. Now you're in renal failure, or, you know, your diaphragm's a muscle, you know, you can undergo like respiratory arrest, right? So it becomes life-threatening and dangerous, but that's not a normal moderate dose of a psychedelic. And it's not a normal moderate dose of an SSRI agent. And it's, you know, typically, unless you're talking about things like ayahuasca that have other monoamine oxidase inhibitors in it, yeah, it's not even SSRIs combined with psilocybin, SSRIs combined with MDMA at normal sorts of doses. And so I think historically, through WebMD, through just myth around what serotonin syndrome is, through sensationalist perspectives of challenging experiences associated with psychedelics, we've gotten to a place where it's very alarmist around the term serotonin syndrome. And in fact, most of the time, if you mix something like an SSRI with psilocybin or an SSRI with MDMA, what you notice is potentially diminished, like potentially, not always, potentially right, diminished effects of the psychedelic, right? And lower levels of physiologic responses, less pupil dilation, less small increases in, you know, body temperature, less cardiovascular types of responses. And so how lower levels of responses in those ways is consistent with life-threatening toxicities associated with just excessive levels of intrasynaptic serotonin, it doesn't make a ton of sense. Sure. And if you're thinking about the classic psychedelics like psilocybin or LSD, I mean, these are drugs where it's very hard to find a lethally defined dose in a human being, and it's arguable whether a person has really ever died from like a direct overdose-related physical toxicity. I'm not talking about somebody was too altered and ended up doing something, was dangerous, sure, or had an accident. That's a behavioral toxicity. That is absolutely possible. Psychological overdose is possible with those agents. But as far as like a physical OD that directly killed a person, right, I don't want to say it's never happened, but it's unclear that it's happened as far as, you know, documented sorts of cases. And so how is it that you got 30 million Americans that have tried a classic psychedelic in your lifetime, and then you've got, you know, somewhere between 8 and 12% of the population taking SSRIs, depending on the graphic you're looking at, and, you know, the literature isn't chock-a-block full of all of the harmful causes and combinations that's occurred out there, right? It kind of gets you to a place of, this really doesn't feel very real, and it's not real based on what we know about classic psychedelics. It's not real based on observational information. And it's not real based on the combination studies that we have in healthy volunteers. And it's not real based on the survey information that we have about persons that have combined classic psychedelics like psilocybin with their SSRI. So excessive serotonergic side effects, yeah, I'll buy that.
Sure.
Right? Because that's just using any serotonergic drugs. And you start mixing them together, trying to augment the benefits of an SSRI with a trazodone or an atypical antipsychotic that also boosts serotonin a little bit, right? Say prazodone or something like that. Okay, it's possible, but life-threatening serotonin syndromes outside of combinations of MAOIs and SSRIs or MAOIs and serotonin-releasing agents, I mean, those are the classic combinations where it's kind of like, yeah, that can absolutely happen. And well, you don't want to mix those. Yeah.
You know, Ben, it seemed like a couple of years ago when I would talk with folks who were running ceremonies, organized ceremonies, or even retreat centers, in their screening process, they would say, well, you have to be off your SSRIs. Now I see a trend away from that where they say, come on. And so, you know, the practices have seemed to change somewhat, just kind of based on what you're talking about there. I don't know how much you have talked or interacted with the folks in Oregon with their above board licensed service centers. So some of those centers, somebody goes in and their process is to start a loading dose that's really a flood dose, very high level psilocybin, whether they're on SSRIs or not. Others maybe have a much smaller loading dose, and then after an hour, maybe give an additional dose. Now, that's outside of what we're really talking here, but do you have any thoughts about that? You know, just about psychedelic dosing, particularly psilocybin.
Yeah, absolutely. And even like backtracking just a second there.
Sure.
Yeah, it really used to be. I think in the early 2000s, it was like, you should never mix classic psychedelics with SSRIs because you'll die of serotonin syndrome. Mm-hmm. Right. And then I don't want to say that I single-handedly like changed culture, but I think a lot of the information that I put out in the psychedelic and antidepressant drug interaction guide that was offered through my website is the most downloaded and popular resource that I've ever created. And I really put it out there around 2016, 2017 or so. So it's been out there, you know, for a while. You know, that chart is on the Oregon Health Authority's like website. It's posted like other sorts of places, right? And so the pendulum really swung from like, I would get persons in 2016 to 2020 that would be like, well, I know that we can't mix these together, so tell me how the person has to get off. And I'd be like, yes. That's not really how I'm understanding it. And then I was really pleased, you know, for a few years there, it was, well, I know it never works in combination, so just tell me how they need to get off. And over time, I think we're getting closer to the truth, which is most of the time, it really isn't a toxic combination. Like the vast, vast majority of the time, it's not. And a lot of people can get pretty significant psychedelic experiences and effects while taking their SSRI. Some people notice potentially diminished sorts of effects. Are those effects diminished 10 to 20% or 50 to 80%? You know, those are going to be big factors, I think, in whether the person wants to taper or not. And then what you're saying, like, what dose should we actually pick, particularly for a person that's on an SSRI type of agent? I think, you know, outside of SSRIs, right? So let's just like put that aside for a second.
Sure.
Right. The doses of psilocybin that have been shown to be beneficial for a treatment-resistant depression type of episode or a depressive episode in clinical trials, we're talking synthetic psilocybin now, mm-hmm. is as low as 10 milligrams. And maybe as high as 30 milligrams, but the most common doses and the ones that seem to work the best are 20 to 25 milligrams. In the state of Oregon, they're allowed to go up to, they use fungus or mushrooms, but it's a standardized type of mushroom and it's dosed based on analyte, right? Or the amounts of psilocybin content that they have. And they can go up to 50 milligrams. So, hey, they can go pretty strong as far as the amount of psilocybin mushrooms that they actually give a person compared even to what we know is helpful for a person suffering from major depression in a depressive episode that they've tested in clinical trials. And so some of this, I think, feeds into who the person is, what their intention is. Frankly, there are some persons that have quite a bit of experience with psychedelics that are coming into these centers. They have tried psilocybin mushrooms or other types of psychedelics, maybe several times at several different doses. They're a healthy adult in their 30s, 40s, maybe early 50s, and they don't have cardiovascular diseases going on at the same time. And so, hey, like, you want to start at 30 to 35 milligrams. And if that's not intense enough, we're going to cap you out at 50, sure. 75 to 90 minutes later, really reasonable. Somebody else is coming because they have a stage 4 cancer and they've never used psychedelics before. And there's some level of medical frailty to them. And they're in their early 70s overall. Am I thinking to start at 35 milligrams and potentially bump them up to 50? Or maybe it makes a whole lot of sense to start them out at 10 to 15 milligrams, 5 to 15 milligrams. And you can always add more, right? A little bit later in the experience if it really isn't taking off that strongly. So again, it's kind of like, who is the person that I have in front of me? Why are they doing this? What yep. other things do they have going on? Right. And
personal
and making a decision that just makes sense based on who they are and what they're really hoping to get out of this and what we think that they might be able to tolerate and what might just be kind of overwhelming and not serving them.
Yeah, this has been fascinating. Unfortunately, we're almost totally out of time, but I need to ask you this. How can folks contact you to find out more about your work and what you do?
So spiritpharmacist.com is my website there. It's a psychopharmacology consulting and psychedelic education related website. So it's more the individual evaluation is probably more the psychopharmacology consulting piece that you're looking for. As far as educational things, right? I mentioned that I do have some free resources, guides that persons can download. I've got a free miniature course about psilocybin mushrooms, right? I have these webinar programs, which are, I call them like tier one related things, mm-hmm. right? And they're in the, $10 to $25, $10 to $30 type of range. There are a couple of hours and they deal with some specific topic, right? And so maybe that's bipolar conditions, mood stabilizers and psychedelics. Maybe that's things like serotonin syndrome or hallucinogen persisting perceptual disorder, adverse effects, right? I have full-on courses, right? Some of these are sequenced, like I have the Psychedelic Pharmacology Master Series. It's a three-part series. The foundation to psychedelic pharmacology. So this is a basic foundational pharmacology course that uses psychedelics as illustrative examples. Hey, bioavailability, what's that? Depending sure. on something like ketamine that's available through so many routes of administration, how does that change how much is absorbed and what the experience might kind of be like, right? So taking a concept like bioavailability and then illustrating it with a psychedelic example. Psychedelic pharmacology by substance is the next in that series. So we take nine of the most commonly used psychedelics that are kind of front runners as far as some of the clinical research or medical safety data that's out there, and then really do a deep dive into each one of those systematically. So what is its mechanism? What is its metabolism? What kind of clinical information is out there? What do we know about the toxicology of it? What kind of other drugs could it interact with, right? So really systematically going through these things, because I think a lot of information that I find out there tends to blur different types of psychedelics Absolutely. Together. So by really separating them out and going through them in this systematic way, I think a person can really get the nuance that each of them really, really offers as far as medical information, but also subjective effects and things like that. And then the final course in that series is the most robust course, is the biggest course. And this is the clinical pharmacology of psychedelics. So now thinking about how do psychedelics interface with mental health, neurologic types of conditions, microdosing, mm-hmm. other therapeutic applications, walking through of all these different classes of substance, antidepressants, stimulants, benzodiazepines, sleep aids, analgesics, over-the-counter kinds of agents. What about cardiovascular risk? What about these, big adverse sorts of effects that are quite scary out there? How do we kind of safeguard persons and avoid those? So that's the Psychedelic Pharmacology Master Series. And then in the last year, I've started a 6-month training program, which the courses are kind of tier two, and the training program is the most robust offering I have. It's about biomedical assessment, screening, and preparation. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of persons that are, I think, really have an advanced interest in the science if they're on the psychotherapy side of it. But I think mm-hmm. that this program is really cut out for the medical provider, the medical practitioner. So got a lot of physicians, a lot of, Good. Psychiatrists, psychiatric mental health, nurse practitioners, different types of pharmacists, psychiatric nurses, emergency department nurses, and other persons that are involved on the emergency side of things are oftentimes very interested in that type of program. So really depending on who you are, what you're searching for, all the way from the individual to a medical provider that's looking for something really robust as far as biomedical assessment and training, you can find it all at spiritpharmacist.com.
Well, Ben, thanks for your time today and really for the important work you're doing. I appreciate you sharing your knowledge and experience with us today. Keep the faith, Ben. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Blessings. Thanks for what you do, Jim.
Thank you.
And that, dear listeners, concludes another illuminating journey inside the revival. Our thanks to today's guests for joining this mindful conversation, and to you, our listeners, for being part of the movement towards consciousness, connection, and compassionate care. Inside the Revival is produced by Silencia on Healthcare Now Radio, where innovation meets intention. Remember, the psychedelic revival isn't about escape. It's about the engagement with the self, the spirit, and the shared human experience. For more episodes, visit silencia.com or find us on Healthcare Now Radio. Follow the conversation using the hashtag Silencia, that's PSYLENCIA, and hashtag Inside the Revival. Until next time, keep questioning, keep expanding, and keep listening.